Dog, you did some time to cap jail for left hand. Didn't like the way your tan was in the morning.
Excuse me, is this thing on?
Whoa.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
You're welcome.
Guitar up.
One,
turn
two,
that guitar
three.
That the brown acid that is circulating around us is not specifically too good. Of course, it's your own trip, so be my guest.
And there was just a sea of people. By this point, of course, the fences have come down. We must have been 350,000, 400,000 people. And I was standing next to Bill Graham, and he turned to me and said, "You know, Eddie, if these kids riot, we're dead." I said, "Thank you very much, Bill. I'm going back to my truck now."
There is always a little bit of heaven in a disaster area. Oh, baby, how you die? Well, I'm dead in my body.
The Woodstock was almost like, it was like stepping stones all leading up to that momentous few days, you know. And it's indented in my mind. I mean, just talking to you, I can feel it as just as if I was up there.
Give me an F. Give me a U.
Hi, this is Joe Cocker. In the studio.
Hi, this is Robbie Robertson.
Hi, this is David Crosby with Red Beard, the Mighty Beard.
It's been years since the Woodstock Festival was held on Max Yazger's farm in upstate New York. Since then, the event has been analyzed, mythologized, now digitized, and miles of film and audio tapes, including the full sets of many of the bands who performed over the 3.5 days there, have resurfaced. But have you ever wondered, why Woodstock? It turns out that the promoters had a plan to entice a legendary performer who lived in Woodstock at the time to headline the event, no less than Bob Dylan. But Dylan never took the bait. To explain why Woodstock, here's Robbie Robertson of Dylan's backing group, The Band.
When we first went to Woodstock, I guess in 67 or something, when we moved up there from New York City, when we were working with Bob, it's where we could find the privacy, really, to be able to put our music together. When we went up there, it was this charming little art colony. There was a beautiful innocence to it. It had great charm. There was no scene. There was no nothing there, you know, except the quality of life. And a lot of people had lived there for many, many years. So when we went up there, it served our purpose that we were able to put our music together. We found this house, Big Pink, that we were able to do all of the basement tapes in and music from Big Pink together. All of these kind of things, it all was just lovely the way it all laid out. After the Woodstock Festival, it changed everything. It became the most famous small town in the world.
I pulled into Nazareth. I was feeling about half past dead. I just need to find some place where I can lay my head.
Looking exposing. There ain't nothing that you can see. It's just old Luke and Luke's waiting on the judgment day. Well, Luke, my friend, what about young Italy? He said, do me a favor, son, won't you stay and keep me Santa Lee company?
Stage performing at the Woodstock Festival, the band did Robbie Robertson's song, The Wait. Again, here's Robbie Robertson.
The reason they called it the Woodstock Festival was only because the band and Bob Dylan lived in Woodstock up there, and it had this, you know, a story behind a story in it, you know, that there was a mystery, and what are they doing up there in those mountains, and it was embracing that, you know, with all good intentions and everything. And nobody, you know, meant any real harm by it. But the fact that the Woodstock Festival wasn't even in Woodstock, it was like quite a distance away, actually. But what the repercussions had on this place is it just made everything change.
We must be in heaven, man. There is always a little bit of heaven in a disaster area.
Between 300,000 and 500,000 estimated concertgoers at Woodstock witnessed career-launching performances by several rookie acts, including Santana and Joe Cocker. But tens of millions more would see the film of the event, which followed a year later. Joe Cocker covered the Beatles song With a Little Help from My Friends at the Woodstock Festival, something that none of us, including Joe, will ever forget.
How important to your career, Joe, was that performance?
God, I mean, it's indented in my mind. I mean, I can, you know, just talking to you, I can feel it as just as if I was up there. You know, I mean, it's hard for me to explain how coming, you know, playing from 200 people in pubs in Sheffield, which is about as big a crowd as we got in the pubs. And then a year later, after having Little Help, I remember meeting D. Anthony in London. We were doing a gig at the Marquee Club in Soho, and he just said, you know, do you want to come to the USA? So, I mean, it was like, wait a minute, you know, I mean, the USA was just something I watched on television, you know, like seeing Mr. Ed, and right. a half hour sitcoms was like,
right.
And I suddenly saw this money, like $2,000 a night that we'd be going out for and stuff. It was beyond our wildest imagination, you know, so the Woodstock was almost like, see, it was like stepping stones all leading up to that momentous few days, you know. And I just felt like it was, when I walked out that morning onto that stage, it was like, you can talk to a lot of artists and they'll tell you the same, that you can sing to 50,000 people and get their attention, but once you kind of step over that mark, once you get into 100,000, it's not the same. You're trying to reach a different consciousness level almost, you know, to get everyone to be aware of you.
Sing out of key, yeah. Oh, baby, how you like? Well, I need it, my buddy. I tell me when you say it no more. Oh, I can love my friend. I got to buy the thing over here. Everybody got the love I need.
Oh, I got it.
my friends together. So all we gotta do is love now. I'm gonna take them home with me now. You gotta get on to your friends. You gotta get on to your friends.
Next, Graham Nash and David Crosby recall their second gig, during which the superstar trio became a party of four. For this and your other favorite rock star interviews, visit inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, in the studio for the anniversary of Woodstock, Part 2.
Now, there's a guy up there, some hamburger guy, that had his stand burned down last night. But he's still got a little stuff left. And for you people that still believe that, you know, capitalism isn't that weird, you might help him out and buy a couple of hamburgers.
Hi, this is Joe Cocker in the studio.
Hi, this is Robbie Robertson.
Hi, this is David Crosby with Redbeard, the Mighty Beard.
And it turns out that the scale of the Woodstock Festival, August 15, 16, and 17, 1969, left indelible memories in many of the performers long before they even went on stage. Here's Graham Nash of Crosby, Stills, and Nash in the studio.
My main Woodstockian memories are not music, but visuals, senses, feelings. My memory is that it was like early evening, dusk. Taking the helicopter in there with my friend and our drummer, Dallas Taylor, having the back tail rotor go out 16 feet from the ground and spin the helicopter into the ground, and so we nearly lost it right there. That was my first memory. And also, flying over that crowd, Crosby puts it really well, it was like having an aerial view of the encampment of the Macedonian army. There were hundreds and hundreds of thousands of kids. There were fires, there was smoke, there was color, there was rain, there was mud. It was a very interesting thing to fly over and witness from the air.
Take it and leave it.
The song Sea of Madness from Crosby, Stills, and Nash's set features a lead vocal by Neil Young, a former band member with Stephen Stills, in the then-defunct Buffalo Springfield. Here's David Crosby with me in the studio.
Neil is brought on at Woodstock. What had transpired?
We already had planned. You know, we knew that we wanted him in the band. He was so strong. He's so strong.
It was amazing to everybody that there was enough elbow room for the three of you. How was the decision made to even contact Neil? Was it a real friendly?
We almost didn't have any choice. He was our friend. He was right there. He was so good, you know. And we wanted him. He was such a powerful songwriter. We knew that it would involve our you know, making room for him, but we knew we could do that, you know. And the guy just was too. The songs that he had were so good, you know, and he was such a force. Really, it felt too good not to do it.
Mainstream magazines such as Time and Newsweek chose to do a lot of Woodstock Festival bashing on the event's 20th anniversary in 1989, only to yearn wistfully for those days a mere 5 years later. Graham Nash has a theory.
There's so much interest from the kids today about the 60s. That's why, you know, I think it was the last time that the children ever thought that they could affect their destiny and direct their future. And I think the last time was the 60s, and I think today's kids yearn for a simpler time like that. That's why all those 60s kind of things are happening again, because I think today's kids want to know what it was like when kids had freedom to make love, to smoke dope, to criticize their governments, to criticize their parents. It's not like that anymore, is it? You know, it all happened as part of this great thing that we refer to as the 60s, which probably didn't start until 65 and probably didn't end until 72. But it just happened.
The roads are fairly clear now, so if any of you decided that you've had enough music and you're getting a little tired, yeah, there may be one or two. You can get buses out of Monticello. Everything's cool. Everything's very cool all the way around. Help us with the water and the garbage. Those are the two things that you can do. Thank you all again. It just keeps going. It's lovely.
The Woodstock Festival was unforgettable to fans and bands alike, but to at least one legendary group, the memories are painful. According to Grateful Dead drummer Mickey Hart, every time band leader Jerry Garcia would approach his microphone while wearing his guitar on stage in the middle of the night, Garcia would get shocked. Here's Mickey Hart with Bob Weir and Phil Lesh of the Grateful Dead.
That maybe was such a painful, scarred moment or scarred area for us all that we just didn't want to look at the studio again. It wasn't our best moment.
No, but it wasn't our worst either, Mick.
No, it wasn't our worst. What would you think would be our worst moment?
Well, I don't. Yeah, I Woodstock.
Fellow Bay Area band Creedence Clearwater Revival had the dubious task of taking the overnight slot at Woodstock after the Grateful Dead, and CCR band leader John Fogerty has never stopped teasing the Dead to this very day.
So yeah, the song Green River is drawn from my childhood. That's from a cabin up on the Puta Creek up by Winters, California, that my parents used to take. Wow, they're dropping like flies. This is a long story.
The entire audience.
Wow, this is just like Woodstock.
This is
when they sent me out. We followed the Grateful Dead, and oh my God, 500,000 people asleep. Oh, geez. Anyway, zing, pow! Oh, sorry.
Walking
Next, you'll hear the legendary performance by Jimi Hendrix at Woodstock, along with observations on what the Woodstock Festival means today from Robbie Robertson, Marty Balin, and Paul Kantner of the Jefferson Airplane, Graham Nash, and David Crosby. For these and your other favorite interviews, visit inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio for the anniversary of the Woodstock Festival, Part 2.
Hi, this is Joe Cocker in the studio.
Hi, this is Robbie Robertson.
Hi, this is David Crosby with Redbeard, the Mighty Beard.
From inthestudio.net, with Bob Dylan choosing not to come out and play in his own backyard, the Woodstock Festival promoters chose to close the star-studded three-day concert with Jimi Hendrix, whose meteoric rise to international fame had begun barely 3 years earlier. Here's Hendrix's biographer, John McDermott.
By the spring and summer of 1969, the original three-piece Jimi Hendrix experience, which was Jimmy, Mitch Mitchell on drums, and Noel Redding as the bassist, they're probably the one of the biggest acts in the world. They certainly were the highest-grossing act as a concert attraction, particularly in the United States. They're one of the first groups who were able to sell out sports arenas and headline major festivals. And I think that 3 years of intense touring wore apart the unity that had been there when they launched the band in October 66. By the time June 69 came around, as successful as they were, I think Noel Redding felt stifled, that he did not have a creative role in the group, and he decided to leave for a group of friends in a band called Fat Mattress, and the experience, as it were, broke up. In June of 69, their last performance was at the Denver Pop Festival. Hendrix then went upstate to New York in the Woodstock town of Shokan and just wanted to write and refocus. And I think at that point, there were a number of people that came in. Billy Cox was his old friend from the Army and from the Chitlin' Circuit. Ultimately, they recruited Larry Lee, a second guitar player who also, like Cox, had played on Stax Sessions and other R&B and blues records from the South. Mitch Mitchell stayed around because, you know, he was part of the experience. Well, one gig that had been on the schedule was Woodstock, ironically. You know, he did an appearance on The Tonight Show in that summer and really just it was laying low, but Woodstock was on the docket. And so they ultimately started turning those rehearsals into, you know, serious work, and the Woodstock Festival was their debut.
Here's Jimi Hendrix bass player Billy Cox.
So we did the Woodstock. We tuned at half a step down, which enabled him to reach some of those notes and bend the strings in a particular way. Then at Woodstock, we didn't have a keyboard or horns or strings, so we could all tune down to E-flat. It made his strings a little more pliable, whereby he could do a lot of bending.
Yeah.
Again, Jimi Hendrix biographer and archivist John McDermott.
You can, in fact, argue that there are greater Hendrix performances, but I think that fans, you know, for some reason, just the link between Jimmy and Woodstock is so strong. For many years, the Woodstock album and movie kind of crystallized Jimmy's performance, the Star Spangled Banner and Purple Haze particularly, as the highlight of that original festival. I think for many, many people, their memory of Woodstock and Jimi Hendrix is intertwined. So it's an important release for people. It's a touchstone for people of Jimmy's generation, and I think for young fans, they look at it. It's one of those iconic moments where they're saying, you know, if I get one Jimi Hendrix live album, it's probably going to be live at Woodstock.
Just as white light through a prism is found to contain all of the colors of the rainbow, the Woodstock Festival, as seen through the prism of time, reveals the full spectrum of opinions on the Woodstock impact. First, Jimi Hendrix biographer John McDermott.
Well, I think the thing about Woodstock that's interesting in Hendrix's career is that he was the artist they had selected to close the festival. He was debuting a new band, and, you know, it was somewhat of a risky venture for him. But I think that it was something that, you know, he did not place a great deal of significance, like many people did not, until Woodstock actually happened. And I think that, you know, the movie, for many people, made it seem as if there were a 500,000 people there and that it was, you know, an incredible performance. And, you know, that really stoked the legacy of Jimmy at Woodstock. You know, hey, he didn't get on until Monday morning when many people had already left. He was with a band that, you know, this was their first major performance. And so there were moments where things, you know, weren't as cohesive as they were with the experience. But he was trying material that he had never played with the experience. So there's something to be said for that. So it's a fascinating performance. I will say that if you listen to this particular performance, you hear arrangements and soloing and playing that Jimmy never really played ever again. Certainly not with those players, apart from Cox and Mitchell, who we played with in 1970. But he never played with a big band concept like that ever again.
sister.
Once again, Robbie Robertson of the band.
And it became very, very touristy, very hippie touristy. And that was somewhat interesting for a while, but then it wore off and it started to, a darkness settled in. You know, a dark cloud kind of settled over the place. And that original charm for the people that had lived there so long and all of these artists and everything, they started feeling somewhat betrayed by what had happened to their, you know, their innocence in this place. And there was nothing that anybody could do about it. And the whole style, lifestyle up there, it became different. And people were just showing up at your doorstep. And that whole sense of being, you know, off the map in a place where you could really just concentrate on your work and your art and not have to think about these other things no longer applied to the place. So it wore out for me after a while.
Woodstock Diary, August 15, 16, and 17, 1969, with some entries from Marty Balin and Paul Kantner of the Jefferson Airplane.
But one thing I tried to touch on was that the spirit that was existing in the 60s is continuing to go on and on, and no one's really put their finger on what the 60s did, except that does exist and is still here with us, and you can see it everywhere around the world.
Yeah, the stuff that went on in Tiananmen Square.
Yeah, everywhere. People wanting freedom, people wanting capitalism. I mean, those ideas just get bigger and bigger, and the problems keep getting bigger and bigger, and we have to confront them. We keep becoming more and more one person thinking, let's try to save what we got.
Once again, here's Graham Nash.
I always felt that you couldn't redo Woodstock. You couldn't recreate it because it was so much a product of the times, of the way that kids felt about themselves, of the drug era, of the freedom for all the kids era, of the self-expression of the children. It was all tied up in that kind of emotion, and those times don't exist. So my thought has always been that you could never recreate it. But you can celebrate what happened by bringing today's hot bands together and trying to do a similar thing. Not to recreate Woodstock, but to in fact celebrate the fact that, you know, 250,000, 500,000 kids could get together and kill each other.
David Crosby.
I wouldn't touch it with a pole.
Why do you say that?
Because you can't recreate the past. I mean, you know, there's the truth. You know, there's no way you can. A lot of the main things that happened at that thing, a lot of the main people aren't even alive anymore.
It's true.
And you can't recreate the past anyway. You know, it's just not real.
Find the cost of freedom buried in the ground. Mother Earth will swallow you. Lay your body down. Find the cost of freedom buried in the ground. Mother Earth will swallow you. Lay your body down.
Good night.
God bless you.
Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young at Woodstock, August 15, 16, and 17, 1969. I'm Redbeard. We'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking all of my guests who, as Joni Mitchell reminds us, are stardust. They are golden. In the Studio was written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2014, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and visit us, inthestudio.net.